the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again and welcome to the program. Coming up, despite a massive culling program, feral pig numbers are on the rise again, with farmers in the northwest reporting the worst numbers they've ever seen. There's a call for more funding.
Since they had the pig shoot, it was pretty good, and I think that was in November, end of October, November. But since Christmas, kind of over February, March, we've seen a lot of pigs running on the place, like mobs of 10 and 15. Eunice saw a mob of about 20 the other day, and we're setting up traps for them. Yeah, they have increased, but I don't think it's just for here. I think it's everywhere.
And women shearers increasingly treading the boards in the sheds around the state. We'll hear more about that shortly. But first up today, let's turn our attention to the Senate, because New South Wales farmers and various other agricultural lobby groups from around Australia are fronting the Senate inquiry today to protest at the proposed new biosecurity levy being placed on farmers. Xavier Martin, president of New South Wales Farmers, says the new levy is just another tax on growers who are already paying for biosecurity controls through the nose. He says travellers and the freight container industry should be asked to step up, as they're the ones that are most likely to bring in pests and diseases. Responding to the users pays argument, Xavier Martin says farmers may benefit from a clean, green environment free from pests and diseases, but so does every other Australian and our general economy.
Yes, Michael, I'll be saying to the senators that farmers should not have to pay an additional tax to fund biosecurity. Farmers, agriculture that is already paying more than its fair share towards funding our national biosecurity systems, and we're calling on parliamentarians to vote against the levy bill and stop this double tax on farmers. We're already paying Animal Health Australia or Plant Health Australia or both, and we're already paying for emergency response deeds that we're signed up to for response to biosecurity risks. It's not us that are creating the risk. We don't deserve to be double taxed. It's the risk creator that must pay.
And the risk creator being?
Well, as we speak, there's people walking in through the airport. There's containers being unloaded at the ports. Barely one in 100 of them gets inspected. You know, there's just risk coming in all over the place without the level of surveillance that those that are causing that risk, that is the people walking in, flying in, the people that are coming on boats, the goods that are coming, we've seen it time after time. That's how these pests and diseases arise.
So you think that the onus should be thrown back on, say, like the freight industry to some degree, more than it already is?
Oh, yes. And look, we've got strong support from a whole lot of other sectors that know they're creating the risk. And this is what the senators, I'll be alerting them to, that those that are creating the risk are actually putting their hand up. And those academic individuals that are assessing the situation, like ANU, have come out with assessments that demonstrate that, you know, there are other segments of the chain that need to have a contribution collected, and that's where that money needs to come from and needs to be applied, not take another tax from farmers, particularly at a time, you know, farmers are already contributing a huge amount, and you know, to come up with a new tax at this time is just extraordinary.
So this is levies that they pay, say, through grains organisations or wool organisations or beef organisations that they're already paying that are slated specifically for biosecurity.
Yeah, well, what farmers see is that they are paying a four, five or six figure sum every year, year after year. And some of it goes to R&D, to those corporations. Some goes to Plant Health Australia and Animal Health Australia for biosecurity. And some goes to the National Residue Survey Scheme. So all in all, there's a whole lot of levies being taken off farmers. Now, this proposal is actually a tax because it's just taking it and putting it in consolidated revenue, and it's quite the nonsense. New South Wales Farmers is recommending that we get a system in place that operates on a cost recovery basis for all those risk creators, the passengers and the produce that is entering Australia. And that'll ensure that those risk creators share their cost responsibly, not burdening farmers with an additional tax just because they believe they can.
Now, the freight industry have also said that some members of the freight industry have put their hand up, as you say, and said, yeah, actually, we probably should pay more because we are a risky enterprise in terms of some of the countries that we're coming in with the containers. They're not cleaned out properly. We know that we need to do our job a bit better, and maybe we should be paying more.
Yeah, look, the data shows we're losing this battle 1, 2, or 3 pests per month.
Mm.
We're not winning the battle. So we do need an enhanced effort. What we don't need is a new tax on farmers. And look, it's only 8 weeks until this proposed tax is meant to be introduced, and yet we still don't even know how it could be collected. And we know that the only thing we really know is it's just going to go into consolidated revenue. So it's just a tax grab by the Albanese government, which is just appalling. Every agricultural group opposes this levy, Michael. They just can't see the merit of it at all. So even the Productivity Commission and the ANU, as I mentioned to you, they view it as flawed policy.
And even the University of Melbourne, they put out a paper as well saying that, the freight and container, there should be a container levy. So there definitely is quite a bit of support for other people to be paying other than farmers. But, I mean, from the dry economic standpoint, users pays, you would think that farmers should be paying for biosecurity levies, as a devil's advocate. What's your response to that?
Oh, we already are. I mean, farmers are paying 4, 5, or 6-figure sums every year, year after year, as I've just described. I mean, some of them are paying levies every year more than the value of their motor cars they drive around in, Michael. So just think about that. If the average Australian business person or citizen was shelling out that sort of money to try and care for the biosecurity of this island, and that's the contribution that we're making. I mean, this is where the rubber hits the road. We're making the effort, and they've identified a problem, and as I've outlined, that we're losing the battle on this island to maintain it pest-free and disease-free. We're down to probably less than 1,000 major pests and diseases now. And, it's not that many years back, there was 2,000. We were free of 2,000 pests and diseases. Now, the reality is yes, we've got a problem. Yes, we've got to address it. But typical of Canberra, they've come up with a solution that's actually going to make the problem worse, taxing farmers.
And it's not like the general public doesn't benefit from biosecurity as well, in a whole range of ways. I mean, just one example is fire ant.
Oh, exactly. If you want something to tear up the way of life for the Australian citizen so they can't walk in the park or can't play cricket at the cricket ground, it's just been infested. Fire ant is a classic example of a serious and insidious pest. And don't get me started on the failure to respond to that over the last couple of decades.
Xavier Martin is the New South Wales Farmers Association president. He'll be speaking to the Senate right about now. It's 13 minutes past 12.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, the wool was flying off the board at a shearing competition in southern New South Wales over the weekend. More than 100 shearers from across Australia took part in the Wagga Wagga Speed Shear event, vying for a place on the team to compete in Wales later this year. For the first time, the event included a section for female shearers, and reporter Emily Doak went along to find out a little bit more.
Shearers, nod your heads. 3, 2, 1, go.
Loud music, live commentary, and furious action.
And he's hit the long blow there and absolutely flying.
The speed shear all comes down to shearing just one sheep as quickly and cleanly as possible. Too many nicks or wool left on will see you disqualified, and most can do it in under 30 seconds.
26-27, looking for the cord.
Organiser Atta Takanawa Simonov says the sport is gaining in popularity.
Oh, we're lucky enough to host the Wales team this year. The Royal Welsh Committee have sent over a first ever speed shear team. New Zealand, Falkland Islands, Scotland. Yeah, so we've got a few internationals.
And a few locals as well have taken part?
Definitely a few locals, but we also have an event called State of the States, so we have the best of those states here as well. They're the top two that have made those classes, and they'll challenge to go to Wales as well. to be recognised internationally. That's how we want to sort of promote our industry. A lot of people aren't aware of the agriculture industry within shearing, but also that our industry has had a hit, and we just want to encourage people to come along into that industry. Yeah.
And you, something unique's happening here in terms of you've got a special section for women. Why has that been incorporated?
I myself enjoy shearing, not the best, but I wanted to promote that as well. And as we would see and know within the industry, a lot of women are coming up to your records. We have one that's got 2 world records. She's the first ever woman to have ewe and lamb record at the same time. So it's history, really, history making.
And I love the title, you've called it I Am Woman. Mm-hmm. So this is showing that women are here in this industry making a difference.
I'm empowered by them myself too, so I enjoy it.
How do you think that the women compete with the men in something like speed shearing?
I think the way that they have picked up and taken it to a professional level, I think they give them the shakes now. Yeah, it's just anyone's game, they're that good.
Sasha Bond broke 3 world records last year, including shearing 720 lambs over 9 hours. But she says, unlike the endurance record, speed shearing means you've just got one chance to get it right.
With a speed shear, you only have one sheep. So, you know, your comb selection, your footwork, and calming your nerves have to be quite quick. Whereas with a record, you have all day to do it. So,
time to get into the rhythm.
Yeah, that's right, exactly.
What about the actual physicality of it? Do you put in much training?
For the records or the speed shears?
For both, and for work.
I train a lot. For the world records, I train 7 days a week in the gym, an hour a day, and shore 7 days if I could, weather permitting. And it helps out heaps with my shearing day to day, and it was essential for the days of the records. Fitness levels have to be right on if you want to push your body to those kind of limits.
And I suppose looking at the role of women in the industry more generally, we're seeing that here there is a special division, I Am Woman division. As someone who's been at the top levels of performance in the industry, how do you see the move to sort of have a separate section for women?
I think it's great. It would be good if the prize money was a bit closer to the males division, but in saying that too, because I'm a woman, I can compete in both divisions, where a male can't compete in the women's division and the open or any other grade. So in a way I'm sort of lucky, because I get a test, a trial run before. It's cool to see so many women getting up and having a go.
Okay, so my name's Tanya Tufangai. I've been a wool classer for 25 years, and we've got a shearing run in Western Australia. So my great-grandmother, she was one of the first female shearers in New Zealand, so it's just been something we're born with.
Do you reckon it's a good career for a woman?
I think so. With the price of shearing now, you can make a good quid, and yes, definitely a good lifestyle as well.
So you're all the way in Wagga Wagga, New South Wales, and you're competing today in the speed shear?
Yep. I entered in the novice, but I didn't do very good. I got red-lighted, so that means you're DQ'd, so the quality wasn't quite there.
26.27 seconds have been our fastest two so far this morning.
Some of the action at the Wagga Wagga Speed Shear event, and that report put together by Emily Doak. It's 19 past 12.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
Well, feral pig numbers are on the rise once again, with farmers in the northwest particularly reporting the worst numbers they've ever seen. Rain and plenty of fodder have combined for almost perfect breeding conditions. The population explosion has prompted calls from New South Wales Farmers Association for more state government funding and extra resources, as President Xavier Martin explains to Christy Reading.
Well, I think what I'm seeing is more and more in the paddock, in the creeks, in the dams, and of course travelling to meetings at night. I'm seeing more on the road at night, and whilst it's welcome news that there's a program on foot that's killed 87,000, that's the target, 87,000, I think it's 69,000 they're up to now, the problem is that, there's 4 to 100 million feral pigs in Australia, and you know, 63,000, heading for 90,000 by July, perhaps culled. You know, that's not even 1% of, well, not even 10% of 4 million. So, I mean, the reality is that unless we can control 80% of these animals, they're outbreeding us. The rate at which sows reproduce is just outclassing our ability to control them.
What damage are they doing? Tell us about the reports you're hearing.
From my own experience, Christy, in the last few weeks, I've been on the heather and beans and sorghum and finishing one paddock of sorghum. I thought, oh, there might be 3 or 4 still here in the paddock. And then I thought, no, there might be more like 30 or 40 still here in the paddock. And then just as I finished the last bit, there was about 80 large pigs made a break for the neighbours. And, you know, that's the reality. They're not just a few. There's an extraordinary number. And, you know, they kill lambing ewes and the same with calving cows. You know, they wreck fences. They're just a huge menace. There's so larger numbers now, they're starting to attack people. Like, I've been charged and upended off my motorbike. And a woman just west of us, I heard, charged at the clothesline. And, you know, they're just an extraordinary menace, an extraordinary pest, carrying disease and a big threat to biosecurity.
What additional support is required here?
Oh, look, farmers are paying thousands each for their efforts directly and indirectly to try and control these animals through LLS rates, etc. And we need government to top up that spend. It's too big for the communities to handle alone. And, you know, I think it's welcome that the Minns government put forward that $13 million with a target of controlling 87,000 pigs by July this year, but we're really just getting a little bit to bacon and we need the whole hog, Christy.
Yeah, okay. So what do you want to see in the next budget? I mean, we're talking about, as you mentioned, a $13 million feral pig program. It started in October of last year. What do you think would be a more adequate spend or way to spend?
Oh, look, certainly the cost per pig of helicopter shooting is high, but I think the combination of baiting and trapping and helicopter shooting is how we're going to get that 80%, that point, tipping point, where we can actually reduce the numbers rather than them outbreeding our efforts.
That's New South Wales Farmers Association President Xavier Martin. Now, the numbers are not just those numbers increasing. That's not just limited to the northwest. On the Northern Tablelands, Inverell farmer Angus Vevers told Lara Webster that the pest has been a significant problem for the last 2 years and the populations are growing again.
Since they had the pig shoot, it was pretty good, and I think that was in November, end of October, November. Since Christmas, kind of over February, March, we've seen a lot of pigs running on the place, like mobs of 10 and 15. Eunice saw a mob of about 20 the other day, and we're setting up traps for them. Yeah, they have increased, but I don't think it's just for here. I think it's everywhere. You know, people I speak to from out at North Star, they've got massive problems out there compared to us, but yeah, they are increasing a lot.
What sort of impact is that having on your own operation? I mean, you have livestock and crops.
Like, because we've been into them quite well, they're doing a bit of rooting up the ground and all that type of stuff. We grew a crop of soybeans for silage, and I was expecting to see quite a bit of damage, but because we trapped about 50 or 60 in weeks before we cut it, we got rid of quite a few, and the damage wasn't that much. But if we hadn't have started to trap them, I think it would have been badly damaged, big time. And they were all big pigs too, not too many little ones. When you look at, you know, get up in a plane and have a look at the scrub around us here, we've got the Kings Plains National Park and a lot of country between east of us, a lot of scrub country. They're doing a very good job, but they can't, like, they'll never get all of them. You know, there are some people that don't want hunters on their place, or not hunters, but control of pigs. But all our neighbours here work very well together in trapping and that. Yeah, look, it's probably their budgets. They've probably not only got pigs to do, they've got a lot of other things to do. But, yeah, I think, you know, having a coordinator is a good idea, but one bloke for New South Wales is not probably really strong enough.
Inverell farmer Angus Viver speaking to Lara Webster. Local Land Services says despite nearly 70,000 pigs across the state being culled, the feral pest is still a concern. The culling program was launched in October last year after a $13 million injection from the New South Wales government to help address the rising population. Feral pig coordinator Beck Gray told James Parris the program is battling against favourable conditions for pig reproduction.
We've managed to deliver quite a few aerial programs. We've coordinated with landholders to establish coordinated groups for feral pigs. And so far we've managed to remove 69,000 odd feral pigs from the environment, which certainly is going a long way to try and to reduce that population that exists across the state.
You said there's a couple of different programs that have been used to get these numbers. Tell me a little bit about that and how exactly they've been working.
Yeah, so we've been able to coordinate 36 aerial control programs so far, aerial shooting programs. We have another 10 of those to deliver in the next couple of months. They're happening across all of local Land Services regions. We have three landscape scale project areas, one of those which is in to the west of Moree in the Lower Gwydir area, another one around Coonabarabran and Coola, and another one further south down at Lake Cajeligo, the wider Lachlan area. So in addition to those three landscape scale project areas, they're quite large project areas, local Land Services regions have also identified some other priority program areas where they can further target feral pigs.
What would you say if someone said that the feral pig numbers are the worst they've ever seen across our region and in some other parts of New South Wales?
Well, they certainly are an ongoing problem, and we've seen the last few years have been really, really favourable for feral pig reproduction. This feral pig program came on the back of three really good years. And even this last summer, you know, expecting to come into this summer being really hot and dry, but that's certainly not what we saw across the state, was it, for the most part? And of course, that just means that there's more feed availability, feral pig reproduction rate, you know, can really be maximised. And that new generation of pigs is coming through into almost perfect conditions, you know, over the summer period. As summer crops ripen, there's plenty of feed about. The control effort really needs to increase in line with that population growth, and that's what we're trying to achieve with this program, is to get more landholders working together with their neighbours so that we can try and keep that population at a more manageable level.
New South Wales Feral Pig Coordinator Beck Gray speaking there to James Parris. You're listening to The Country Hour, 28 minutes past 12.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Investigations into the deaths of around 150 Northern Territory cattle while on board the Brahman Express bound for Indonesia suggest the likely cause was a parasitic disease known as coccidiosis. When about 100 cattle started showing signs of illness on the boat, a similar event was unfolding in an export depot near Darwin, where another 50 cattle died. The cattle all originated from one station in Central Australia. The Northern Territory's chief vet, Rob Williams, explained the findings to our reporter, Matt Bran.
So we've obviously been spending a lot of time investigating this mortality event, and I can only comment about the event that occurred in the Northern Territory, of course. I have no visibility of what occurred on the live export shipment. But, unfortunately, we weren't able to come to a strong conclusion around this, but the evidence that we found probably strongly supported a coccidia diagnosis, or coccidiosis as it's called, but there was also some evidence for a botulism in there as well. Some of the other toxicities that we've definitely ruled out were a lot of common plant toxicities, but I guess it's probably fair to say we still can't definitively rule out some of the other sort of what I call more minor toxicities, but yeah.
Have you ruled out botulism?
No, we couldn't definitively rule that out. There was some weak evidence in there for botulism, but the strongest evidence we found was for coccidiosis.
Okay, so tell our audience what coccidiosis is.
Yeah, so it's a large parasite that just sits in the normal gut of most cattle. It's also common in the environment, a bit like Clostridium botulinum, and usually it doesn't cause significant or any disease, particularly in adult cattle. Sometimes when you bring cattle together in a more intensive situation, you can get outbreaks of it, particularly in younger cattle. And the other thing about coccidia is that it's one of those things that even if you do have a burden in there, it's usually you can manage it out. You don't have to, like, there are treatments that you can give, particularly the calves, but you don't often have to medicate for it. It's definitely not a contagious or an infectious disease in the classic sense of a disease, but it's one of those things that cattle normally live with, and usually most of the time it's all good.
So have you ever come across a mass death of cattle from this?
We haven't seen that sort of thing in the territory, but it's well recorded in the literature with Australia and New Zealand, particularly in feedlot situations. So that's where we do see that potentially becoming a burden. And also, again, there's nothing to rule out. There could have been multiple causes here, and certainly Clostridium botulinum or botulism is still in that list of differential diagnoses. But the evidence that we found pointed more towards the coccidiosis.
That's the Northern Territory's Chief Vet, Rob Williams. The Northern Territory Government investigated the cattle deaths at the export depot, while the Federal Department of Agriculture investigated the deaths on board the Brahman Express vessel. In a statement to ABC Rural, a DAF spokesperson says coccidiosis has been identified as a potential cause of the deaths. However, a definitive diagnosis has not yet been reached. You can read more about it online if you search for ABC Rural. It's coming up to 29 minutes to one. Shortly, we've got a text in from Dave who's saying, I put the squeeze on the Bureau of Meteorology for some rain in the Central West because it's getting very dry again. So I'll do that in a second. And pigs as well. People are talking about pigs, saying absentee owners and older owners don't help control the pigs. And this person says they're spending an hour every day and there's no other neighbours assisting. He says it's like pushing the proverbial uphill. No wonder there's such a problem with pig numbers at the moment. And we'll get some more texts coming in a moment as well. I'll read them out shortly. But before we do that, let's get some news headlines. Random Story, he's here. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael. We've got a coroner's finding in the in relation to the death of two Aboriginal girls in Bourke 36 years ago. And, excuse me... A warning that this story does contain the names of Indigenous people who have died. The magistrate, Teresa O'Sullivan, has found that Alexander Ian Grant plied the two girls, Mona Lisa and Jacinta Smith, with alcohol after offering them a lift in his ute in December 1987. The 40-year-old was driving when the vehicle rolled and killed the two teenage cousins. The magistrate says she was satisfied by witness evidence that Grant sexually interfered with Jacinta's body after she died. Now, the coroner said the initial police investigation was tainted by casual racism and unconscious bias towards the Aboriginal community and contained serious deficiencies. The federal government is promising to fight the tech billionaire Elon Musk as he continues to rail against a demand to remove a video of the stabbing attack at the Sydney church last week. Last night, the E-Safety Commissioner won a two-day injunction in the federal court to force the platform X to take down the vision for all users, not just those in Australia. And the crossbench senator Jackie Lambie has thrown her support behind the government's right to target X, and she's used some fairly strong language in that regard.
As she often does
and should. The gaming regulator has found that Crown Sydney is now suitable to hold a casino licence after an extensive probation period. It faced multiple allegations of money laundering and links to international criminal syndicates, but was given an opportunity to redeem itself. And the gaming regulator has found the company has fully fulfilled those obligations. Rack 'em up.
here we go again.
Here we go again.
Yep. Everything on the black.
Yeah. In another matter that's familiar to us all, cost submissions in Bruce Lehman's failed defamation bid against Network 10 and Lisa Wilkinson underway. And one submission shows the former Liberal staffer rejected an offer to settle the case less than 2 hours after the offer was made. The parties are arguing who should pay for the case. Network 10 is asking Bruce Lehman to pay all the costs after their settlement offer was rejected. And there's a bit of worry with the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, and his PNG counterpart, James Marape, beginning their two-day journey along a section of the track. One of someone who's regarded as one of the most experienced guides, Charlie Lynn, he's voiced safety fears regarding parts of the trek. He says for the last 3 decades, there's been poor management and deterioration on parts of the track and its camping facilities. He's described one area above what's known as the Brown River as a potential death trap for tourists, whether they're going along that part.
Okay.
I don't know.
No, I don't know. No.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was an interesting place to be in Anzac Day.
Yeah.
Mm. On the Kokoda Trail.
Yeah. Mm.
All right, well, you'll be back at 1 o'clock. We'll be listening.
That's me.
Okay. Yep. We'll talk to you then, or we'll listen to you then. We won't talk. We'll talk to you, but you won't hear us.
You can do whatever you want.
Adam Story there with the news headlines. Let's find out what's happening with the weather. Ed Medlock is at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael. How are you doing?
Very well. So I got that, as I was just saying before, we got a text from Dave in Trundle. He says, put the squeeze on the Bureau for some rain in the Central West. But it doesn't sound like there's much coming for the Central West.
Yeah, it might be a bit of a disappointment for them. The showers are really just in the northeast for the coming week, and it's pretty much dry and sunny everywhere else.
Dry and sunny, what, right across the state? Maybe some coastal showers, or not even that?
Well, a few coastal showers in the northeast pretty much for the coming week. There is a cold front passing through tonight overnight, which is going to cool things down, and that might bring some showers to the ranges around the Hunter, and then back to showers in the northeast for the remaining period, really. Those cold temperatures are actually going to be around the southern ranges for quite a few days, and in fact, it might actually get some frost out in Broken Hill in the southwest. It's going to get pretty cold, but yeah, the showers are really not anywhere except the northwest, northeast.
Okay, so and sunny during the day, maybe some frost in the morning. Is that what we're looking at? And maybe, but it's sort of sunny and warming up during the day.
Yeah, that's right. And these cooler temperatures are going to stick around pretty much until the weekend. It's basically southerlies all the way through, which is going to cool things down. And early next week is when things can expect to warm up.
Right, warming up, but no sign of any rain, really?
Not on the horizon, no. It's seeming like a pretty dry spell for the coming week. Yeah.
For certainly at least for the next 7 days, except for a couple of showers here and there.
Yeah, just showers in the northeast. Yeah, nothing inland really for the next 7 days.
Okay, and those showers talking only a few millimetres?
Yeah, a few millimetres, kind of 5 at sort of a maximum. So yeah, nothing crazy.
Okay, all right. Ed, thanks for that.
Cheers, Michael.
It's coming up to 22 minutes to 1 on the Country Hour.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, after years of extinction, a small handful of eastern quolls are once again calling the mainland home. 19 quolls have entered the animal version of Love Island in a semi-wild safe haven in Boundary National Park on the New South Wales south coast, where the race is on to couple up and start making babies by June to get those numbers of quolls increasing. Tasmanian Quoll Conservation Program Director Wade Anthony tells us a little bit more about that program.
Eastern quolls have been extinct on the mainland of Australia for about 60 years, and this is largely to do with the introduction of the red fox.
This isn't the first time you've released some quolls in that on the mainland. What happened back in 2018, 2019, Wade?
Well, there was a project that we were involved with where Parks Australia and WWF embarked on a trial project to rewild 20 eastern quolls over a 2-year period, so 40 animals in total, into the wild of Boundary National Park. Now, this was a, an area that had really strong fox mitigation over a long period of time. But unfortunately, that population didn't survive. So the foxes were a major cause of that, along with roadkill was another major cause. So there was some significant learnings out of that trial project. And so the key stakeholders involved there, Parks Australia namely, have embarked on the construction of a safe haven with the plan to establish a semi-wild population there over a period of time and probably looking to put animals back into the wild in the national park in the years to come.
So what exactly makes this project different? You've learned and they've created a safe haven, but then there is a plan to release them into the wild eventually. Why would they survive this time when they didn't last time?
Well, I think the animals, this time around, the animals will go into a semi-wild space, so like I said, an 84-hectare space where they'll be required to sort of fend for themselves, you know, establish a population over years, so there'll be offspring born into that space. They may, you know, become a little bit more suitable for release into the wild, but I think a key factor will be the mitigation of foxes. One thing we discovered last time around was that there were a small number of foxes within the area, and over time, that was all it took to remove a large number of these quolls.
And so are there works underway at the moment to remove those foxes?
Yes, I believe there are. This has been ongoing at Wootaree for, you know, 15 or 20 years, fox mitigation, but, you know, they're a very hard species to remove from the wild.
Why do we need quolls on the mainland? What's the importance of having more populations of them?
Well, they're an ecologically important species. They lived on the mainland for, you know, a long period of time prior to the introduction of foxes. They fill an ecological niche in the wild, and it's this is part of a larger plan from the federal government where there's a number of listed priority endangered species to try and re-establish or reintroduce back to the mainland of Australia, and this is one of those.
And so 20 of those were released last Thursday. How many of those were raised here?
On this particular release, and this will just be the initial release, this captive population at Wootaree will need to be supplemented over time. But there were 5 animals came from Tasmania and 15 from the mainland.
And how long before we know if it's a success, and how do we know that it's a success?
Well, these animals will be very closely monitored by the project team at Wootaree. One of the key factors, I guess, will be breeding. So eastern quolls typically breed in June each year, so these animals have been strategically placed in the safe haven prior to breeding, so a mix of males and females of good, you know, genetic suitability. So one of the key takings, I guess, in the short term will be the reproductive success of these animals.
So you've sort of created Love Island for the quolls.
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
You place them there and you're hoping they'll couple up in time for this year's breeding season?
Yeah, that's correct, yeah. So they've got, you know, 6 or 8 weeks to sort of settle into their new environment, and then, you know, they'll be certainly looking to breed in June. So it's a really exciting time, and we'll know. The gestation for this species is only 21 days. So, you know, come the end of June, early July, the guys on the ground there will be monitoring females, capturing, checking pouches and things like that.
I think you've just created a reality TV show with quolls.
You could look at it that way.
Wade Anthony doesn't sound convinced, does he? Director of the Tasmanian Quoll Conservation Program, telling Meg Powell about the group of quolls that have been released for the first time into a semi-wild, purpose-built safe haven on the mainland. It's 16 minutes to one.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Sally Sara. Join me for The World Today. A showdown looming between the federal government and tech billionaire Elon Musk over a confronting video of the stabbing at a Sydney church. Price check. One in four customers finds it difficult to tell if an item is discounted or not. Supermarkets urge to use clearer price labelling. And solar gardens. City renters buying a share of renewable energy in the regions. Those stories and more coming up this lunchtime on The World Today.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, let's look at the feral pig issue because we're getting quite a few texts on that issue. Someone's suggesting sodium nitrate bait's the proven painless process to kill off feral pigs. So suggest that's Dennis in Ballina saying that's the best way to go. Barney says Xavier Martin forgot to mention that the local land service rates are also used for biosecurity as well, but someone's texted in saying the LLS experts have been asleep at the wheel again, and we'll get rid of as many farmer directors as we can via the pay cuts. The absentee owner issue, which we talked about earlier. And Greg from Hilston says feral pigs, before the creation of local land services, feral pigs were declared not a noxious pest under the RLPB Act. Landowners had to eradicate them. The obvious lack of control measures is obvious with the explosion of numbers. Greg says it's another reason to get rid of local land services. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's coming up to 14 minutes to one. Shortly we'll have some market information. And you can always send us a text on any of the issues that we are hearing about on the program today. 0467 922 684 is the number to text me here at The Country Hour. But before we go to markets, a farmer has paid $63,000 for a two-week-old Holstein heifer at a sale. Two-week-old it is, a Holstein heifer at a sale in New Zealand. The heifer, Busybrook Lambda Footloose, has genetic links to the United States and cows which have previously won Supreme Champion at World Dairy Expo. So it's certainly got some runs on the board in its family. Darren Crawford from Crawford Holsteins told our reporter Josh Becker that it will become a genetic foundation for his new stud and his long-term dream to return to the dairy industry.
I was in the industry up until around 6 years ago in 2018, and then sold the cows I had and the farm I had in northern Victoria, and had this opportunity to come here and on one of our family farms and do cropping and beef. So I jumped at that, and currently farming it between Cootamundra and Gundagai. Just looking to go back to dairy in the next couple of years.
Wow, that's really interesting. Darren, tell us about this heifer you've bought, a two-week-old heifer for $63,000. Tell us a little bit about her.
Yeah, that's right. To some people, it probably sounds like a significant amount of money for a two-week-old calf, but the genetics behind her and the cow line she come from second to none, I think. They're a proven line and just a family I really want to get into and develop here in Australia.
What was the auction process like? I'm told there were 200 people attending in person, about 500 online.
Yeah, I'm not sure on the numbers of how many people were there. I was over in New Zealand in person. I took mum over with me and a friend, and we were there in person to buy the heifer.
What is it that's special about this line and these genetics?
I think like the dam of this calf is she was supreme at World Dairy Expo in 2022, and the third dam back, she had also had a lot of success at World Dairy Expo in North America, which is pretty much the biggest show in the world and in the stud game, and both of those cows have had in the past bulls in AI and have bred on really quite well, and everyone in the stud game, those couple of cows are household names and everyone knows who they are.
What about buying a calf at 2 weeks old for $63,000? Is there a risk in buying stud cattle so young?
There is, but the vendor did guarantee the calf until 3 months of age, and then that's when I take on the responsibility. But, they're cows. You can get insurance for them, so that will be the process just as a backup. So for me, it sounds like a lot of money, but I think with insurance these days, you kind of can't lose.
What do you think people in the industry are thinking when, as they hear this story today about a 2-week-old calf selling for that kind of money?
I think they will be, you know, a lot of people, depends on their what kind of system they have at home. If they're in the commercial industry, maybe that will seem a significant amount of money. But I think in the stud industry, it, you know, that kind of number in North America, you know, it's pretty common. You know, they make a lot of money over there. It wouldn't be a first. But I guess in this country, it doesn't happen too often. Animals getting sold or bought for that kind of money. But the idea is with this calf, once she hits, you know, 10, 12 months old, you know, she will start an IVF program. You can do them every 2 weeks and do them to sex semen. And you can do them whilst they're pregnant up till sort of 3-4 months in calves. So if it all goes well, and which hopefully it does, and she produces oocytes or for ovaries, you know, you can multiply quite a few progeny quite quickly in today's day and age.
So, Darren, does this mark a significant milestone for you and for what you're hoping to do to get back into, I guess, the dairy stud side of the business?
Yeah, she's definitely going to be one of my foundation females moving forward. You know, over the next 2 or 3 years, I plan to be back milking. For the moment, I've just been buying in embryos from North America out of some elite families and flushing a few of the other cows that I bred here back sort of 6 years ago, which is still at my brother's farm, and just putting some good cow lines together. And yeah, no doubt this Footloose calf will be one of the foundations, and hopefully breed on.
So Darren Crawford from Crawford Holsteins paying $63,000 for a 2-week-old Holstein heifer, and he was talking there to Josh Becker. In some other news, the Australian Veterinary Association, they want the federal government to provide education fee relief to vets to address a workforce shortage in rural and remote areas. The Regional Education Commissioner made that recommendation in its latest report to encourage early career vets to work in rural communities. The Australian Veterinary Association President, Dr. Diane Baker, says it's an important solution, this sort of fee relief to the vet shortage crisis. And in other news, dozens of workers from Saputo Dairy in Tasmania's northwest will walk off the job from midday, so we don't know whether they've done that as yet, but they may well have done so already. They're calling for a pay rise that matches their mainland counterparts. Now, the Australian Manufacturing Workers Union says workers at the Burnie processing site are earning 21% less than their co-workers at a sister site in Victoria. And Michael Wickham from the union says it's just not fair for Tasmanians to be paid less. Let's go to markets. Let's go to Wodonga Cattle first up.
Good afternoon. Just under 1,000 cattle offered at Wodonga, 1,000 less than the previous week. And the yarding was rather plain with a limited supply of well-finished cattle. Not all buyers were active, particularly in the export class. The market saw mixed trends and prices were distorted due to the lack of numbers. A few veals sold from $3 to $3.80. Trade steers were limited, selling at $2.50 to $3.54. Heifers attracted both feedlots and domestic buyers, selling from $2.40 to $3.52. Feeder steers of medium weight traded from $2.80 to $3.36, lifting 15. In the export sale, very few steers were offered, with the bulk selling from $2.70 to $3.10, and the bullocks sold at $2.46 to $3.02. Sorry. Heavy cows, they sold 16 cents cheaper, selling at $2.15 to $2.45. The middle run of leaner types, $1.36 to $1.95.
Let's go to Forbes Sheep and Lambs now.
Good afternoon. Lamb numbers eased to 17,100. The quality was good, with an outstanding run of heavy trade and heavy lambs. There was only a small tail of light lambs. All the usual buyers were operating, competing at a dearer rate. Most lambs had gains of $15 to $20 a head. The few two-score processing lambs, 60 to 110, trade weights, 22 to 24 kilos, 142 to 185, an average 695 to 725. The 24 to 26 kilos, 169 to 198. Heavy lambs, 26 to 30, 178 to 23, averaging 725, with extra heavies topping at 236. The best of the heavy hoggets reached 155, up $20. Mutton numbers eased and the quality was very mixed. Prices were similar. The medium weight ewes 42 to 76. Heavy crossbreds reached 110. Merinos with the long jacket 105, and most average between 235 and 260. And this has been Graham Richard at Forbes.
Let's go to Carcor Cattle now.
Numbers fell by 1,700 for Yarni and 2,000 cattle. Quality remains good with mainly feeder types penned, along with good supply of prime yearlings and grown cattle. Not all the regular buyers were operating and competition lacked in places. Young steers to the trade eased 10 cents. Feelers sold from 208 to 248 and yearlings to process 260 to 349. Prime yearling heifers gained 15, selling from 210 to 334. Light to medium weight feeder steers were up 8 cents, while the heavies dropped 10. They sold between 296 and 372. Feeder heifers remained firm, selling from 213 to 316. Prime grown steers were 25 cents cheaper, selling between 224 and 282, while prime grown heifers were 12 cheaper, 230 to 282. Cows dropped 12 cents, 2 and 3 scores sold from 120 to 216, and prime heavy cows 205 to 232. Heavy bulls sold to 220. This has been Angus Williams for MLA at CTLX.
Let's go to Gunnedah now and get the details on the cattle market.
Good afternoon. As mixed as I've seen it for quite a while is how I'd describe the offering, where numbers almost halved to 1,340 head. Cows well supplied, as were feeder steers with permanent teeth. A reduced field of buyers for a market of varying trends. Weaner steers to restockers were firm to dearer, however carried less weight, 250 to 394 cents a kilo up to 330 kilos. Firm to cheaper the heifer portion, 254 to 300. Medium and heavyweight yearling steers a shade dearer, 294 to 363 and 280 to 360 cents respectively. Medium and heavyweight yearling heifers to feed also a little dearer, 270 to 334. Grown steers to feed sold to a dearer trend when taking teeth into account. 4 to 500 kilos made from 240 to 368 cents, mostly 2s and 4s, while the heavier weights, including 6 and 8s, made from 272 to 332 cents. Breed was a factor. Cheaper trends in the cow market to process, with heavy 3 and 4 scores down 16 to 18 cents, 185 to 216, while a strong restocker order saw the plainer condition medium weights sell from 166 to 190 cents a kilo back to the paddock. James Armitage for MLA in Gunnedah.
Thanks for that, James. Let's go to Inverell Cattle now. With the details, here's Stephen Adams.
Inverell reduced considerably to 580, cows most affected decreasing over 1,000 head. Regular buyers attended, not all exporters competed. Weaner steers significantly dearer, 222 to 380. Light feeders cheaper, back 43, 250 to 338. Medium feeders 270 to 360, up 13. Light restockers back 24, 220 to 364 with a quality correction. Light heifers to background improved 18, 240 to 278. Similar weights to feed 15 deer at 270 to 292. Medium feeders back 12, 226 to 298. Restockers competitive for medium cows improving 15, 150 to 192. Heavyweights cheaper processors back 4, 166 to 210. Heavy restockers slip 7, 176 to 199. Stephen Adams, MLA at Inverell.
Let's go to get the details of the Scone cattle sale now.
Good afternoon. After a big week of selling cattle last week, where Scone agents yarded 4,000 cattle with the combination of the prime sale on Tuesday and the weaner sale on Thursday, numbers were down by 60% today for a yarding of 476 head. Not all the regular processing orders at the rail, whilst there were some added local restocker orders. Restocker steer weaners back 10 to 19 cents, 220 to 358. Over 330 kilos, 290 to 300. Restocker heifer weaners, similar falls, 204 to 282, with B muscles making to 305. Medium weight yearling steers to lot feeders up by 9 cents, 248 to 290. Over 400 kilos making to 300. Light 2 score cows back 20 cents, 116 to 190. Heavy 3 and 4 score prime cows back 7, 190 to a top of 221 cents. Angus Barlow for MLA at Scone.
Thanks for that, Angus. And you're listening to The Country Hour. That's the market information for today.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Nearly the program for today. We'll be back with you between 12 and 1 tomorrow. But the last word goes to Greg at Ningen. He was tickled pink by the story about the sanctuary for quolls. He said it's great news about that sanctuary for quolls, and we should certainly see more of it. But he also makes a point that it's pretty dry in Ningen at the moment. And I gather that, having heard what it's like in Trundle, so there's obviously parts around the state in the central west and elsewhere that are looking for a little bit of rain. But no rain, as we heard from the Bureau, no rain to speak of really for the next 7 days. So we'll keep looking at that for the latest details. You're listening to the Country Hour. We're heading up to news time at 1 o'clock.